travel and summer go together like, well, let's ask a travel expert.
Sicily is just a barrel full of cultural monkeys in a lot of ways. There's you got to remember, if a place has been just destitute and never had any economy, right, there's not much there in the way of souvenirs from the past.
Techonomics host Jason Middleton speaks with someone who has been heading to Europe for decades. Rick Steves has gone through trials and tribulations just so the rest of us can have a better travel experience. Coming up next are several summer travel tips.
Hello and welcome to a travel-centric edition of Techonomics. We have Rick Steves with us. If you know the name, you know he unearths the things that help travelers better enjoy an experience, not just get a good deal. Mr. Steves has spent 100 days a year in Europe since 1973. That's a lot of data collection. And his new edition of the travel guide, Best of Europe, is in print, digital, and in an app that is more like an opt-in docent experience than anything else. Here's my chat with Rick Steves just before he took off for this year's European foray. I hate to pull you back out a little bit, but I do have to ask a macro question because, as you said, we have very, very short vacations as Americans, and so we want to maximize that time abroad. For people who don't travel that often, do you suggest the two-inch headline cities first and then dig down, such as Rome, Paris, London, and then maybe second tier on the second visit?
Well, Jason, there's two approaches. You can do the grand tour and blitz Europe in 3 weeks or whatever you have, and then you can go back and do various places after you've had that sampling. Or you can be a little more patient and perhaps mature and say, I'm going to go several times over the course of my traveling days, and I'll start with Britain, and then I'll move into other places that are more challenging. I do think it's important to start mild. Don't start in Turkey. Start in England and Ireland, and then, you know, then you can go to the Netherlands and Germany and finish in Italy or Greece, or, you know, you work from mild into exotic. I personally like the exciting greatest hits trip to start things off with, and that would be, you know, we have 30 different tours. We take about 20,000 people around Europe on our tours every year. Last year we took 900 groups, about 30 different itineraries. One of our most popular is the very first itinerary we ever did, and that's Europe's greatest hits in 3 weeks and 3,000 miles. And that would start in the Netherlands. Amsterdam's a great place to begin. Then you go to Germany and go down the Rhine River and through the heartland of Bavaria, the Romantic Road and Rotenburg and everything, and then the crazy castles of King Ludwig of Bavaria, the Neuschwanstein, like the Disney castle. Then you cross over the Alps and you do Venice, Florence, and Rome, sampling of the hill towns of Tuscany, and then you hang out in the Italian Riviera, the Cinque Terre, and then you go way up into the best of the Alps in Switzerland and the Berner Oberland above Winterlach, and it's the very best one-stop look at the Alps. And then you head over to Paris. You do one stop in the French countryside. I like Beaune in Burgundy and then in wine country, and you finish off with a finale in Paris. Mm. So that's a busy 3 weeks, but that is the greatest 3 weeks that Europe has to offer. You're flying open jaws into Amsterdam and out of Paris, and it's a little heavy on Italy because that's my favorite country. Mm. And if you aspire to do that in 3 weeks, that would be a very, very good first trip. Now, remember, you're not alone when you do that because that's the greatest hits of Europe. So That's going to be pretty crowded. And you're going to have a lot of congestion in the famous places along that route. And Frank's house is going to be crowded. The Vatican and the place where Michelangelo's David is, they're going to be crowded. The Eiffel Tower is going to be crowded. And all of those places that come with great crowds, they also have ways that you can get a ticket without waiting in a line there. So you can walk right to the front and pop right in. And that's really important in your travels. And that's one of my passions when I write my Rick Steves guidebooks, is anytime there's a line, I've got a way to get around that line. If we have good students reading that book, they'll make reservations in advance, and when they get to the Eiffel Tower, they'll be ushered right to the front of the line and put immediately onto the elevator, not because they're a travel writer or anything, but because they're good travelers, equipping themselves with good information, and then using it so they travel smarter.
Speaking of the Eiffel Tower, and I was watching Paris last night with Anthony Bourdain's recent trip, and he suggested not going to the Eiffel Tower is a good use of your time because you can see the Eiffel Tower in so many other ways on so many other platforms. Would you agree with that, or do you think that's something that personally you need to be physically near in order to really experience?
Oh, you can look at it from many viewpoints, and if you like to just look at things, that's fine. I like to experience things. I would say if you want to be a little bit select about the Eiffel Tower, don't spend the money to go to the top level, which is twice as high as the next level down, because it costs a lot more, and the view from the very top It's kind of like looking out the window of an airplane. But when you look from the middle floor, there you get a grand view of Paris. And what I really like about that is I can climb down the stairs very easily. Mm. And it's like taking a hike through a fantastic Erector set in the middle of the greatest city in Europe. You can walk down the stairs. I think the Eiffel Tower is a lot of fun. Anthony might be talking about the frustrations that people have if they don't have a reservation because you got to wait in a long line. But I love to, I make a reservation. I go directly up there. I don't eat in the fancy restaurant there. But there's plenty of amusements at the different levels, and I don't waste the time and the money to go to the very top. But my travelers and I love to go to the Eiffel Tower. One thing you've got to remember is you don't have to go up the tower, as he says, but I would like to go to the Champ de Mars. That was the military parade grounds, literally, where the Eiffel Tower was built to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And from the Champ de Mars, you get that excitement of seeing the Eiffel Tower. One thing I do that's really fun, I lay it out in a step-by-step way in my Rick Steves guidebooks that cover Paris, is to hire an Uber, and then you have a whole list of famous places to see that are floodlit, and you give that list to the Uber driver, and then you and your travel partner sit in the back seat, and at each of those places that are floodlit, the driver takes you there, you jump out, you do a little dance, you take a few selfies, you marvel at that one bit of the City of Light, hop back in the car, laugh, sing a song with your driver, go to the next place, go all the way up the Champs-Élysées toward the floodlit Arc de Triomphe, go around the Arc de Triomphe a few times, and you're giggling your head off, and then you drive over to the Eiffel Tower, and you jump out, and you gaze up at that monster, all floodlit at the top of the hour, it all twinkles, just like it's just going crazy, and then you end up back at your hotel. But that is a real fun hour after dark, and it's surprisingly reasonable if you split it and you do an Uber. And that's sort of a hands-on fun way to enjoy Paris that I think is an example of the efficiency and the joy that we bring in all of our Rick Steves guidebooks.
I was going to say that you can get more of these personalized tips in Rick Steves' Best of Europe. The newest edition did just drop on January the 3rd of this year. Rick, I know you have to go. My last question real quick, a little bit off the beaten path. I am debating personally with my family about Corsica at the back end of a trip to Paris. And we're discussing whether Corsica is a nice kind of wind down before flying home. And you mentioned that Italy, of course, is your favorite country. We're going to be in France. Corsica has gone back and forth over the past few centuries. What's your quick takeaway on Corsica?
You know, I haven't been to Corsica, so I can't really say. I've studied it very carefully. I've talked to people who've gone there, and I've always felt that there's many places that would be much more rewarding for the typical American tourist. I just think there's so much on the mainland that Corsica has never really drawn me. I would love to, you know, hang out in the Italian hill towns in Tuscany and Umbria. I love the Italian Riviera, the Cinque Terre. There's a lot of places I would go before Corsica. You know, you're not wrong to go to Corsica, but I've never met anybody who really raved about Corsica compared to other places. If you want Italy in the extreme, you go to Sicily. I'm going to Sicily in a couple of weeks. And it's just, I can hardly wait. Sicily is just a barrel full of cultural monkeys in a lot of ways. There's, you got to remember, if a place has been just destitute and never had any economy, right, there's not much there in the way of souvenirs from the past. And Corsica has been a country that doesn't have that sort of cultural richness, I think, that you're going to find elsewhere. Sicily is interesting because it's, you know, it's just countless civilization after civilization after civilization has been there. And today there's a lot of interesting history on Sicily that I don't think you'd find on Corsica.
My wife's family's from Sicily, and I can't believe I'm saying this to Rick Steves, but if you need a couch to crash on or if you want to have an all-day meal with the Maggios, please let me know.
That's one great thing about Italy is these drawn-out meals, and only in Italy do you realize, man, we've been sitting here for 3 hours, and they're still bringing out different kinds of post-dinner liquor, you know, and desserts and sweets, and we're still going strong, and that's the beautiful thing about Italy.
This has been delightful. Rick Steves, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Happy travels.
That was Rick Steves, a travel advice icon, if not legend. Mr. Steves is a self-proclaimed militant optimist who is constantly adding things to his books. Now, his new guidebook, Best of Europe, has a new edition just in time for summer travel. And his apps and online resources really are kind of like having a docent in your pocket. In the travel industry on the whole, guided tours and sightseeing used to be the ugly duckling. That's no longer true. It's also a recent turnaround, like in the last 3 years. In Europe, tours and activities account for around $40 billion. That's 2016. Now, here in the USA alone, there are approximately 67,000 businesses valued at $20 billion in the tour and activity space. Now, that number makes it the third largest segment of the travel industry after air and accommodation. All of this is according to webintravel.com. Now, to put a final touch of scale on this travel sector, travelers are likely to spend more on sightseeing than on shopping, souvenirs, and nightlife combined this year. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. If you're a PR executive, you are probably polishing off your resume. Pepsi, United Airlines, and Uber are all shopping for some crisis response experts. Pepsi pushed out a tone-deaf ad where faux protesters are handed a can of soda by no less than Kendall Jenner in the hopes that either that would cure society's ills, one individual's thirst, or maybe help us forget that she's just another Kardashian. As for the nation's third largest airline, if you have not seen the social media video of a passenger being forcibly removed from an overbooked United flight, well, here's some sound.
Oh my God.
United's CEO at first backed his employees' decision to use security forces to remove the unwilling passenger. Then there was about half a news cycle of victim shaming, pulling up the passenger's past and, unrelated to anything, criminal charges. Plus, there was tons of criticism from people who watched the airline space. So then the CEO gets back out there and swears United will never engage in such practices again. That turnaround happened, for the record, after United's market cap turned around about $1 billion in one day. And finally, Uber, where public relations go to die. Uber's PR chief walked out right when the company needs PR the most. After the year Uber's had, I'm just going to leave that one right there. Coming up after the break, a new person-to-person marketplace for highly designed home interior goods with a somewhat precious name of Chairish, C-H-A-I-R. And then we get post-apocalyptic after that with a New York Times best-selling fiction writer. It's all coming up on Techonomics. I'm Jason Middleton. Please come on back.